countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China.
Kabul Bagram Highway, and we are on our way to Bagram District in northern Parwan province to visit Bagram Airfield. The 70 hectares airfield was known as the symbol of the U.S. military power in Afghanistan before its withdrawal from this key site. Now, Bagram Military Air Base, which was known as an American town in Afghanistan, is handed over to Afghan National Army, and the government says having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban. But as this army general says, the government needs more time to either collect all remaining tools, vehicles and other facilities or deploy military forces in Bagram.
Working group are continuing their work inside the Bagram. We don't want to lose the facilities which left by the American forces here. We are assured that we try to use all the facilities. In the future, some of the maybe Air Force branch will deploy here, but the priority right now to secure the area.
We got permission to see some insider parts of the airfield. The first destination is parking lot, where the U.S. forces left their military vehicles. Then we visited the Bagram Hospital. Officials say they are working to make it operational very soon.
The Health Affairs Department of the Ministry of Defense has planned to make this hospital in Bagram operational. That is why we are here working on the plan despite some problems like shortage of power and some administrative issues.
One of the other places to visit is the residential area, but when we were heading to this site, we faced many hideouts being used to protect U.S. forces from possible Taliban rocket attacks. However, it seems U.S. forces have even left their boots behind due to a hurry to leave this largest military base in Afghanistan. Bagram Military Airfield was considered as one of the strategic bases across Afghanistan not only during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, but even earlier during the Soviet Union occupation of the country. Now, the Afghan government should decide how to protect this vast base and deploy Afghan forces here, Sayed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province.
After 2 months of digging into a depth of more than 20 meters, Yemen's Mine Action Center managed to defuse one of the largest U.S. bombs dropped in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The bomb was expected to target the civil defense building in Sana'a.
This GBU-24 bomb from the Paveway series was dropped in 2015 to target the civilian defense building in Sana'a next to Al-Thara Park and Al-Hasaba local market. The Saudi-led coalition has been using various types of advanced American weapons in its war on Yemen. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Observers say this bomb is another proof of the U.S. military support for the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen.
We defused a GBU-24 bomb with a weight of 1.5 tons. The bomb targeted this hangar designated for the maintenance of Yemeni civil defensive fire trucks. The explosion of the bomb could have caused a humanitarian catastrophe with great consequences. The U.S. has provided only a few countries, including Saudi Arabia, with such a bomb.
Over the past years, Saudi Arabia has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. bombs, to target residential areas across the country. Back in April 2015, Riyadh committed one unforgettable crime by bombing the Attan area with a U.S. cluster bomb, killing more than 100 civilians, including women and children. This American bomb dropped by U.S. aircraft is yet another witness to Washington's role in the war crimes in Yemen, as the U.N. turns a blind eye to such violations. Besides the military support, Yemenis say Washington has always been backing Saudi Arabia politically as a major ally in the region. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Security situation is deteriorating day by day in Afghanistan due to the rising Taliban attacks, mainly on key cities and districts across the country. In an assault launched on Saturday, most of the suburbs of Ghazni city in southern Afghanistan came under Taliban control.
The attack pushed back Afghan forces into the city as they struggled to avoid the collapse of the strategic area, which is located very close to Kabul-Herat highway.
Officials in Ghazni say Afghan security forces are strongly resisting in the city, noting that dozens of Taliban militants, including foreign nationals, have been killed as a result of counter-attack operations by Afghan security forces.
The enemy has captured some areas in the suburbs of the city. This is because we tactically retreated from those areas. They also made efforts to enter the city, but we pounded them hard and pushed back the terrorists from the city.
This comes as thousands of locals have also stood alongside the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces to resist against the Taliban, a move which has been supported by influential figures and locals in Afghanistan.
Our great nation has always proved to be alongside the country's national security and defense forces. Our people will once again resist against the Taliban now that the militant group wants to expand its military grip.
Apart from consequences like rising violence and bloodshed in Afghanistan, tens of thousands of local Afghans have so far been displaced inside the country. In such circumstances, many have urged both the Afghan government and the Taliban to rather focus on political solutions to resolve their difference than engaging in a deadly conflict. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Scores of Palestinian fishermen staged a protest against the ongoing Israeli violations against them in the Sea of Gaza. The Israeli siege imposed on the fishing area for 15 years has deteriorated the lives of Gazan fishermen who are dependent on the fishing industry and has badly affected Gaza's economy.
The raw materials required for repairing our nets and boats are not allowed to enter Gaza. This has deteriorated the condition of most fishermen in Gaza. For 15 years, the Israeli regime has intended to close down fishing zones in fishing seasons.
The fishermen syndicate in Gaza organized a protest in Gaza's port. There was also a press conference aimed at highlighting the Israeli abuse against fishermen, namely opening fire at them, arresting them, and droning fishing boats.
I lost my brothers and I lost my money and my source of income as the Israeli regime bombed my boat in 2014. And here I am, participating in this protest while human rights groups turn a blind eye to what is happening to us.
During the latest Israeli offensive on Gaza, Israel closed the sea completely. Since the end of the onslaught on 21st May, Israel has opened the sea for fishermen only for 6 miles, which is not enough for fishermen to get enough fish to help them make money or even provide enough fish for consumers.
The inhumane Israeli blockade has restricted our work for 15 years now. Most of fishermen now lack fishing nets and equipment due to the closure of borders. The Israeli regime is trying to destroy the Palestinian income by any means. The occupiers intend to make us isolated and restrict our daily work.
Under the Oslo Agreement, the fishing range was 20 miles. However, over the years, the Israeli military gradually reduced this range, severely damaging the livelihoods of thousands of fishermen. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is worsening due to the Israeli blockade, which is taking its toll on the life of 2 million Palestinians. Fishermen here in Gaza call on the international community to pressurize Israel to end these restrictions that threaten their daily lives and make it hard to maintain any source of income. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war against Yemen in 2015, thousands of Yemenis, including businessmen, have been forcibly displaced from Saudi territories due to their sympathy with their country. Others have been imprisoned and tortured on charges of being Houthis.
The Saudi authorities practice various types of violations against Yemenis residing in the kingdom. The number of forcibly displaced people from Saudi Arabia, according to the International Organization for Migration, has reached more than 49,000. Saudi Arabia began practicing enforced disappearance and torture of Yemenis because of their sympathy with the countrymen since the beginning of war. This is considered a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Abdul Latif al-Hashimi is one of those displaced from Saudi Arabia. He has established a foundation in Sana'a to expose the Saudi practices against Yemenis and to help those who feel alienated upon their arrival in Yemen after spending decades of their lives in Saudi Arabia. Al-Hashimi says some Yemenis have been displaced or imprisoned because of their last name if it refers to a Hashimi family.
There are Yemenis imprisoned in Saudi Arabia on charges of being Houthis, belonging to a particular sect, or because of their last name if it refers to Hashemite family. Even those who show sympathy with their countrymen suffering from the Saudi war and blockade are imprisoned. Others have their money and trade confiscated. We seek to help those who are deported to Yemen, as most of them feel alienated upon their return to Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The brutal war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
The grievance of forcibly displaced Yemenis from Saudi Arabia exposes another aspect of Riyadh's violations of the humanitarian law. People here say all this comes amid the apathy of most international human rights bodies. Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
More than 2,000 Palestinian teenagers have attended a summer camp held by the Islamic Jihad armed wing to get more familiar with the Palestinian cause and receive due military training for possible confrontation with the Israeli army.
The camp aims to raise the awareness of the Gaza teenagers about the Palestinian cause. Israeli regime thinks that by waging war, it can undermine the spirit of our nation. Camps like this make our children prepared to stand up for their rights against the Zionist violence.
The camp was inaugurated in a ceremony attended by a number of political and military leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement. The leaders said the camp seeks to make the new generation more familiar with the Palestinian cause and demolish the concept of normalizing ties with Israel in their minds.
This camp aims to give training to the young generation on the resistance front's war strategies against the Israeli regime. A number of participants have lost one or more relatives during the latest escalation, and they are here to learn how to cope with the next atrocities.
The number of participants this year was significantly higher compared to previous years. The resistance factions attribute this huge participation to the big victory they achieved against Israel in the last escalation over the Strip.
We came here to learn how to defend our lands. We want history to write about us and how we seek to liberate Jerusalem al-Quds. My message to the Israeli occupation is that the youngest olive tree in our land is older than your whole entity. We are the generation that witnessed wars and killings, and that's why we will keep the resistance and will not give up our land.
The Islamic Jihad says these camps also carry a message to Israel that the Palestinian factions are always ready to defend their rights. Observers here say among its responsibilities, the resistance front should narrate the true history of resistance for new generations to help them understand the true face of the Israeli regime. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Latest figures from the International Organization for Migration show so far this year 898 refugees have died in the Mediterranean Sea while trying to reach EU soil. That's three times more compared to the same period last year. The subject has, yet again, just been debated in the European Parliament.
Europe is no longer in a migration crisis.
That remark by EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson has incensed many lawmakers.
It is quite surprising to be here listening to this debate, and suddenly the Commissioner says the EU is no longer in a migration crisis. Commissioner, what planet are you living on?
Legislators and rights groups highlight reports that EU countries such as Greece and Italy are aggressively pushing refugee vessels away from their shores. Other EU nations like Austria and Hungary have closed their borders to these desperate people. A €6.3 billion fund has been agreed by the European Parliament to help member states manage the refugee issue.
We first need to see improvements in respect for fundamental rights and accountability, and this funding should be made conditional upon fundamental rights compliance.
The EU is continuing its policy of sending billions of euro to Turkey and Libya so that authorities there prevent the flow of refugees to the 27-nation bloc.
Throughout this, European leaders keep resorting to populist solutions of making it harder and harder for people to reach safety.
Campaigners say at no point since the crisis started in 2015 has the EU taken responsibility. They say the main source of the problem relates to attempts by Western powers to destroy and take over Syria. Now EU leaders are being urged to show some compassion and solidarity.
Finally, take political responsibility to break the deadlock in the Council and to agree on a common European asylum system.
However, rights groups say that is wishful thinking. Anti-refugee politicians such as Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban have the power to veto any proposals that are presented here. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Limelight.
In the wake of assassination of Jovenel Moïse, the unpopular, corrupt, and increasingly authoritarian US-backed Haitian president, observers fluent in the history of foreign interference in the hemisphere's first truly free republic sounded the alarm over the same sort of calls for intervention in the name of stability that preceded so many previous American invasions of Haiti. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Haiti Assassination Raises Red Flags Among Observers Fluent in History of U.S. Intervention. Stay tuned for more. In the wake of assassination of Jovenel Moïse, the unpopular, corrupt, and increasingly authoritarian U.S.-backed Haitian president, observers fluent in the history of foreign interference in the hemisphere's first truly free republic sounded the alarm over the same sort of calls for intervention in the name of stability that preceded so many previous American invasions of Haiti. Recently, the editors of the Miami Herald responded to Moïse's murder by asserting that the U.S. must get off the sidelines and act. They wrote, "The U.S. as Haiti's biggest donor has no choice but to take the lead to stabilize Haiti. An international coalition could do immense good very quickly by picking five critical things to focus on, so that basic life in Haiti can continue. Good roads, reliable electricity, clean water, policing that works, and COVID vaccines." The Miami Herald editors were not alone. Robert Fatten, a professor of government affairs at the University of Virginia at Charlottesville, told France 24 that in previous decades, the UN, US, and France have sent troops to Haiti due to political insurgency. If things worsen, I assume we'd have an intervention, unquote. Echoing this sentiment, the editors of Washington Post called for a swift and muscular intervention in Haiti. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said recently at a press conference that the Biden administration is prepared to respond to requests for assistance from Haiti's interim leadership and that the U.S. expects to be in receipt of formal requests for armaments. When asked specifically about the history of U.S. intervention in Haiti and any appetite to intervene again, Price indirectly answered that the United States has an will continue to stand by to provide assistance to the Haitian people. Jake Johnson, a research associate for the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, told Maria Abi Habib of New York Times that there will be a lot of calls for international intervention and sending troops in the name of restoring stability to Haiti. But it's important that we take a step back and see how international intervention has contributed to this situation, Johnson said. There's already been billions of dollars spent on so-called nation building in Haiti, which has only contributed to the erosion of the state and politicization of these institutions. To now say we need to do more of this, well, that won't work. Amid reports that at least one U.S. citizen was among those arrested in connection with Moore's assassination and the mounting calls for foreign intervention, the U.S.-based anti-war group Black Alliance for Peace, BAP, said that it smells a rat. What happens now is the question, BAP said in a statement, adding, will the Biden administration and other political players use this moment as the pretext for military intervention, as was done in 1915? Whatever happens, the Black Alliance for Peace remains steadfast in our call against foreign intervention and occupation of Haiti, the group said. And we call on all anti-imperialist and black internationalist forces to stand with the Haitian people and oppose U.S. and European interventions deployed under the guise of the responsibility to protect. For over a century, the U.S. military has helped corporations plunder Haiti, carrying out invasions, supporting coups, and menacing anyone who fights for the freedom and independence of the country, writes artist and activist Rachel Damond. Even if they use humanitarian language, the goal of any U.S. intervention remains the same. Haiti, site of the world's only successful nationwide slave revolt, was the first country in the hemisphere to win its independence after the United States. Over the course of 13 years, beginning in 1791, Haiti's slaves fought to end not only slavery, becoming the first nation to permanently to do so, but also French rule in a colony that, while only the size of Maryland, produced a much wealth as all 13 colonies of the future United States combined. Haiti was the first truly free nation in the Americas and the world's first black republic. Its revolution also belied the hypocritically egalitarian pretensions of the French and U.S. revolutions, the latter which fought to preserve and expand slavery while declaring that all men are created equal. Haiti's revolution led by Jean-Jacques Dessalines, Toussaint Louverture, Henri Christopher, and others, was a tremendous inspiration to enslaved black people yearning to be free throughout the hemisphere. It also proved a major catalyst for early U.S. expansion, as it led Napoleon Bonaparte to sell the Louisiana Territory to the United States. Thus began the more than 200-year history of U.S. intervention in Haiti. Instead of exalting Haiti's hard-won freedom, the United States refused to recognize the country until 1862. What it did recognize was the crushing debt imposed by France as a condition for peace that continues to harm Haitians to this day. In 1891, U.S. President Benjamin Harrison attempted to acquire a naval base at Mont Saint-Nicolas, prompting Frederick Douglass, the U.S. Minister and Consul General at the time, to declare that there is perhaps no one point upon which the people of Haiti are more sensitive, superstitious, or united than upon any question touching the cession of any part of their territory to any foreign power. Haiti maintained its sovereignty for 116 years until President Woodrow Wilson, who claimed to champion national self-determination, ordered a U.S. invasion in the name of stability following the assassination of Haitian President Jean Wilburn Guillaume Sam. The murder sparked widespread violence, and U.S. Marines rode time, landed at Port-au-Prince, and began forcibly soothing everybody. The U.S. would occupy Haiti until 1934, killing thousands of Haitians who resisted the invaders. Occupation forces and administrators implemented forced labor in service of building the kinds of infrastructure advocated by the Miami Herald editors, Jim Crow segregation, and looting of the country's finances for the benefit of New York banks. Rape of Haitian women and children by U.S. troops ran rampant and unpunished. Following the withdrawal of U.S. troops, successive administrations in Washington, D.C. supported Haitian dictators, including the brutal kleptocrat François Papadoc d'Oliveira, not only turning a blind eye to his regime's gross human rights violations, but also training its security forces. Meanwhile, U.S. economic interests profited handsomely from their investments in a stable Haiti, as they claim. Papadoc was succeeded upon his death in 1971 by his son, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier, who was also backed by the U.S. regime, even as his death squads murdered as many as 60,000 Haitians. Haiti finally held democratic elections in 1990. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a Catholic priest, was elected with two-thirds of the vote. However, less than a year later, he was overthrown in a military coup whose plotters included CIA operatives. In 1994, Joe Biden, then junior U.S. Senator from Delaware, opined that if Haiti just quietly sunk into the Caribbean or rose up 600 feet, it wouldn't matter a whole lot to our interests. President Bill Clinton did not agree, and that year his administration secured United Nations Security Council authorization to stage a U.S.-led invasion to restore democracy to Haiti. Clinton sent 25,000 troops on a nation-building mission, and Aristide was returned to the presidency. However, a decade later, the George W. Bush administration actively worked to topple Aristide's government in events culminating in a 2004 coup in which the same CIA-trained forces that previously ousted the president again played a key role. The nation-building exercises that the United States and its international partners have embarked upon in Haiti and around the world have done little to create functioning states, instead creating a system where questionable actors with little national support like Ms. Moa are propped up. The easiest way to achieve short-term stability, writes The Times' Abi Habib. Daniel Larrison, contributing editor at antiwar.com, argues on his website that the U.S. regime needs to break the habit of assuming that political instability somewhere requires military intervention, whether by the U.S. or others. Writer Joseph Sturgeon III adds that Haiti has been struggling against imperialism from the West since the very day she established her sovereignty. It is time that Haiti establish her own destiny, free from intervention from the U.S. regime, from France, from Britain, or any colonial power. She did not carry out a revolution to be under Western control. She carried out her revolution to be free.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of The Spotlight. Now, on the 15th anniversary of the 33-day war, Lebanon's resistance group Hezbollah has released previously unseen footage of the capture of two Israeli soldiers in 2006. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will be discussing the different aspects of this and how it can be considered a turning point. Or let's say turning a new page as far as the axis of resistance is concerned. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Deputy Head of External Affairs in the Syrian Social National Party, Nael Khalbi from Beirut, and also Manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najim, joining us live from Ottawa. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Now, let's begin with our guest from Beirut, Mr. Khalbi, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Now, this footage shows that these events, how they led to the 33-day war. Now, this was the last time that Hezbollah and Israel directly got into an all-out war. Does this footage spell the beginning of the end, in your opinion, of an era where IDF soldiers were considered invincible?
Well, first of all, my name is pronounced Qaed Bey. And as for the footage, actually the beginning of the end could be traced back to 1982, because it is at that time, at that moment in time, that things changed and that the Israeli army stopped being invincible. people from popular classes, people who had no big experience fighting, took up arms and defended their homeland and actually won battles and drove the occupiers away. Of course, after 82, you had the first Intifada, the second Intifada, and so on. And it culminated in 2006, where the occupying force couldn't penetrate to any basically strategic advantage or tactical advantage for that matter.
Now let's bring in our guest from Ottawa, Mr. Firas Al-Najim. Now, in your opinion, why did Hezbollah choose this particular time, the 15th anniversary of the 33-day war, to release this footage?
Best regards to Press TV staff and all viewers. I think it's the battle is growing and is developing to a higher stage now, especially after the recent battle between Gaza, Jerusalem, and all Palestinian cities rising up together against the Zionist regime. They want to show a clear sign, and they want to warn the Zionist regime with the upcoming developments that Hezbollah is a mighty force. Hezbollah is here to stay, and Hezbollah is truly, you know, strong enough to, you know, fight any upcoming battles, and that Israel should take this warning serious and be prepared for a major loss, or possibly the liberation of Palestine. Because as we know, like if you listen to Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, in his recent interviews or statements, it's been pretty much saying that he believes that he will be praying in Al-Quds soon, that he really sees this. So, you know, I think the situation in the world also is shaping towards that. You can see the public opinion has been changing, and I think this is part of it. Like the media has a big role in fighting the injustice and to clarify the truth, you know, from the falsehood. And public opinion is changing. People are now more and more seeing what Israel is about through social media. And you know, we like a lot of protests are coming here in Canada and different places, and we see that diverse faces are entering this battle against the Zionist regime. Like you can see people from every kind of background now. You can see it before, but on a you know, in a lighter vision. But now it's getting much more bigger and heavier. That people from all kind of, you know, backgrounds, religions, colors, ethnicities, they're standing up against Israel and they're voicing their opinion. And the criticism is growing. You know, Israel worked very hard, and their Zionist lobbies and their Zionist media control and influence to you know, push a certain narrative and to you know, install fear in people in the world. And I think this media right now showing this video is also going to have some type of shaping in the media to acknowledge the strength of Hezbollah, and that they're a legitimate you know, political party and a legitimate army that's there to protect Lebanon and to liberate Palestine in the future.
And interestingly enough, Mr. Al-Najim, the footage includes a digital simulation of how Hezbollah planned the entire operation. Could you please tell us what you think about that particular part?
I mean, it's to show, you know, that Hezbollah is a complex army. It's a sophisticated army. You know, within its capabilities, limited capabilities and capacities, they are a very strong force. You know, they don't have maybe that many fighters. They don't have as advanced weapons, obviously, as the Zionist regime. The Zionist regime is, you know, funded and supported by the majority of the world's powers and countries and systems, and you know what I mean. And they have a lot of advanced weapons. But Hezbollah, within its capacities and capabilities and their experience, are very powerful. And it's you know, it's very clear. Like this video shows how sophisticated and how well planned they are, and you know, they thought they really were gonna really weaken Hezbollah, especially in the Syrian conflict and battle there. You know, they thought they put them in a quagmire and like have them trapped there, and then they would be weakened. But obviously, they learned more and they became more experienced, and they defeated Daesh and all these terrorist groups, and they now they're a lot more stronger of a force. And this is a big threat to Israel, and they should really take it, you know, serious.
Now, back to our guests in Beirut. Now, Hezbollah has on many occasions expressed full readiness to fight with Israel. And recently, let's not forget that Israel's war on Gaza led to a humiliating ceasefire. In your opinion, what does that tell us about the axis of resistance and how strong this has grown ever since?
Well, it's no secret that the occupied people have been getting stronger and stronger. As I said, ever since 1982 and even prior to that, it's been victory after victory, whereas on the military side, Israel has been suffering defeat after defeat. Sadly, we haven't been able to capitulate on the political level, but as my colleague has pointed out, things have been changing on the world scene, and therefore it's getting closer and closer for us to actually capitalize on that change in political scene on the world theater and for us to actually achieve total liberation, in my opinion.
Now, Mr. Al-Najim, how do we see this in with regards to Syria and how the axis of resistance is working there?
Well, you know, Syria has, incurred such, hardships in this last, few years, and they still rose out victorious and patient, and the nation now is reunited as well. And all these terrorist groups that propped up and popped out of, from Syria and from different countries and mercenaries and, world powers supporting them, Hezbollah was able to, their borders secure them as well, Arsal border there, so the terrorists would not come into Lebanon and disrupt Lebanon and destabilize Lebanon. At the same time, they also entered to safeguard, holy shrines and also shrines of or holy places and also historical places such as churches for the Christians and so on, right? So they really shaped the whole region, and Syria was supported by its allies, and it showed that Syria will not be left alone when a battle happens, because a lot of other nations, when I say nations, I mean governments, like illegitimate regimes such as the tribal regimes of Saudi Arabia and all these ones, right? They work and they abandon each other. They supported Saddam, and then when Saddam was, when Iraq was being invaded, they left him behind and just threw him on the side. So this shows that there's a unity between the axis of alliance and also the governments that support the axis of the axis of resistance, that they are one entity and they will not abandon each other. They will stay united and they will support each other through any hardship, and they're willing to sacrifice their lives and anything. Even Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, in one of his speeches, said that I'm willing myself to leave Lebanon and go into Syria and lead this battle myself. And we can see that we're in a very strong position these days, and this is a very dangerous situation for the Zionist regime and these occupiers and settlers. I mean, it's a chance for them right now, I think, to deflect and go back to all these different countries that supported them, I guess, and leave Palestine to be free, because it's going to be liberated. I mean, right now, the Zionist regime, you can see that every border almost has a strong axis of resistance. And also inside Palestine, we have an area such as Gaza. It's liberated, but it's blockaded. But this recent battle showed that Gaza is a very, very strong force, and because they're allied with the axis of resistance. And recently, Ismail Haniyeh visited Lebanon, and he sat down with Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah and all different political factions and resisting groups, and we can see that the unity is growing, and that they will coordinate together in attacks to counter the Zionist regime or to liberate Palestine. I think it's a very strong position. I think this is the way to safeguard human rights, because the human rights violators have no borderline, have no, they don't have a red light. They think they can breach every law. And the main purpose of this, and the reason was, is because the West has gave them a green light to breach all types of international laws and human rights violations. And, they help them bury these. They help them safeguard them from any punishment, from any sanctions, from any accountability, from war crimes court. You know, when the International War Crimes Court got involved, the ICC, International Criminal Court, they said it's a kangaroo court. That's what Netanyahu said. They don't respect any accountability or any, anybody that you know, works for justice. Like, right ahead, they'll disregard them, they will defame them, and this is the work of the Zionist regime. But I think it's coming down to an end very soon.
Thank you very much. Now, back to our guests in Beirut. Now, how do you think that the axis of resistance, and Hezbollah in particular, have been able to gain a foothold in the political dynamics of the region, and how have they been able to change these equations?
Well, as you know, the entire geopolitical stance within the region is basically whether you're with occupation or against the occupation. So it's only natural for people who are against the occupation to have a foothold in that dynamic. That being said, whenever you are stronger and whenever you show force, then you would only have a bigger foothold and you would have more to say when the negotiations are gonna happen. And this is why the whole axis of resistance has risen into prominence these past few years, much more so than ever before. I would like to add something to what my colleague said regarding the enclave within Palestine. It's not just Gaza. We can't forget Raqqa, we can't forget Lid. These are cities within what the Zionist movement considers their inner court. And yet, there were actual battles. Of course, you have an occupying force terrorizing a civilian population, so it's in no way a fair battle. However, you had people revolting against oppression, against occupation, within these lands that the Zionist movement considers their own.
So are you as optimistic as Mr. Al-Najim in the way that media and footage like this are helping shape public opinion regards the axis of resistance?
The media definitely has a big role to play, but I'm more optimistic when I see things on the ground. When I see Lid, and when I see Akka, and when I see Haifa rising in solidarity with Al-Quds, and again in solidarity with Gaza, this is what makes me optimistic. The media does have a role to play, but it's only minimal when it comes to the engagement on the ground. The engagement on the ground, the results of these engagements over the past 20 years or so, or 30 years even, these results are what make me optimistic, and I think these results will only culminate in the total liberation of Palestine from the sea to the river.
Thank you very much. Mr. Al-Najim, now tell us, how do you believe that the situation has changed since 2006, and that war that proved to be a major failure for the Israeli army? And as far as Hezbollah and its deterrence capabilities are concerned.
Yes, I mean, you know, Israel was known to be the army that can never be defeated, and they're the mightiest army in the region and so on, and they're the strongest, let's just say. But when Hezbollah, with a small amount of fighters, dedicated, you know, united, and has a very strong leadership and support by Iran and obviously other allies, it showed that they could defeat the Zionist regime, and they can humiliate the Zionist regime, and they can show how weak they really are. As Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said, they are weaker than the spider web, obviously, okay, the house of the spider. And we've seen that in the battle of 2006. You know, I remember at that time when I was watching the news, the Zionist regime at that time, the leadership, they had their clashes while the battle was going on. Another thing is that they were so arrogant, but so foolish at the end of the day. All their decisions they made, showed that they're not really capable of having a battle with a really united, strong resistance, you know. And you can see that because they had three points that they said that will not be broken, and that this is what we want as a strategy and as a goal. That was that they would pull back Hezbollah. You know, obviously Hezbollah, we have to mention it again, because media has a big role of defaming and manipulating things, calling Hezbollah a terrorist organization, and call them terrorists all day and brainwashing people. And we know Hezbollah is politically popular, and they've been elected, and they have MPs inside the Parliament of Lebanon. So, I mean, it's absurd when you call them terrorists. The real terrorist entity is obviously Israel, because they're a bunch of mercenaries, and they're still bringing more mercenaries in. But anyways, is that they would pull them back from the Litani River, okay? So they push back Hezbollah. They would destroy their arsenal, their arms and all that, and that they would not negotiate on the prisoner exchange. So they would Hezbollah has to release them unconditionally. Hezbollah said, and Sayyid Hassanullah said, from the beginning of the time when they captured those invaders and those occupiers of Palestine, that they will not negotiate until the release of Samir Kuntar. And that was one of the prisoners that has been in the Israeli regime's prisons for many years. He's not even a Shia. He was, at the time, he was a Durzi, and he was a revolutionary man, a Lebanese man that wanted to fight and go inside Palestine and try to liberate it. So he went inside and he was captured. But main point is, he said that we will not release until this man is out and certain people. And he was, you know, persistent. He was patient. He was decisive, and he stood for what he stood for in the grounds, and they fought, and endfully, the United Nations had to get involved. They got the UNIFIL to be, you know, in between the border lines, and they couldn't achieve those goals that they put on, you know, on the news and everywhere. So it shows that who was the real winner? Hezbollah. Hezbollah is not a full army. I mean, it's not a full army, and it's not a full government. It's part of a government, and it's a resistance on the border there. So it shows that this small resistance can defeat this mighty army that is supported by most of the world. So truly, Hezbollah
showed... We're running out of time, by the way, Mr. El-Najim. So.
Sorry, I just want to tell you that Hezbollah showed an example for anybody that wants to resist, that you can win, that this enemy is weak, and they're working on, you know, on a weak base, and that, you know, that we can liberate Palestine if we work hard and united together. And I think this is the outcome and the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That was manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Mr. Firas Al-Najim, joining us live from Ottawa, and also deputy head of external affairs in the Syrian Social National Party, Nael Qaed Bey from Beirut. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight, and thanks for following us. We'll be right back.